Raymond Raven reviews Dupuytren's contracture, diagnosis, and treatment options. Dr. Raven is CEO and managing partner specializing in hand and upper limb surgery at Orthopedic Surgery Specialists, Burbank, California. He was recorded at the K.P. Dale Daniel Orthopedic Symposium presented by Kaiser Permanente and their Meetings and Events Department.
In terms of history, I'll make it brief. You know, we all think of Dupuytren, but it was in 1614 that the first case was described about a flexion contracture that was thought to be due to this pathology. And in 1777, it was later discovered that it was a palmar fascia. Eventually, fasciotomy was found to be a form of treatment for this disease. And then Dupuytren in 1831 was the first to give a description about the anatomic and pathological aspects. Dupuytren was made famous in the French military. He was responsible for treating the hemorrhoids of Napoleon. And he was the one who noted that when you release the cord, you release the contracture. And he was the first to perform a successful fasciectomy as opposed to a fasciotomy. So I want to mention this because there's a lot of controversy and some confusion, controversy among docs and confusion among patients and docs about what really constitutes Dupuytren's disease. There is an entity that's described well by Ghazi Ryan of non-Dupuytren's palmar fibromatosis. And probably most of what you see out there that we think is Dupuytren's is probably this. And the difference is that there is no family history. It's often unilateral. There are no ectopic manifestations, and we'll talk about what those are. It can be associated with a ganglion. You can see it a lot, and I see it a lot as an upper extremity surgeon after prior ipsilateral trauma to the hand or even the shoulder. You can see it in smoking and alcoholism and diabetes and cardiovascular disease. But the most defining characteristic of non-Dupuytren's palmar fibromatosis is that it's non-progressive and sometimes partially regressive. So think about that. Palmar fibromatosis or Dupuytren's disease is the most common type of fibromatosis. It's a nodular proliferative process of the palmar aponeurosis, and I'll talk about that. It can involve the adipose tissue and the dermis. There are social and environmental factors involved in palmar fibromatosis as well as Dupuytren's. Direct trauma. I don't know if you've seen people who fall, they tear the palmar fascia, they develop this palmar fibromatosis. It's not Dupuytren's disease, it's non-Dupuytren's. Things that cause ischemia, such as aging, diabetes, smoking, and then as I mentioned before, indirect trauma associated with ipsilateral swelling of the hand, vasomotor disturbance, and secondary ischemia after trauma to the upper limb. And then there are always drugs and alcohol that can cause this conversion of xanthan hydrogenase to xanthan oxidase, which we'll talk about more. So in Dupuytren's disease, there is a genetic predisposition. The inheritance pattern is somewhat variable and not completely understood, but there is an autosomal dominant pattern. And then there are some genes that we see that are upregulated in the nodules and the cords compared to control fascia. And these three genes, ADAM12 and POSTIN, which are associated with accelerated abnormal cell growth, and TNC, which is associated with fibrotic disease and cell migration. And I mention these because these will be on tests that you take, self-assessment tests and OITs and all that stuff. So the pathogenesis, this is a big complex model, but what I want you to take away from this is that there are all these factors involved in developing Dupuytren's disease, which ultimately cause free radical formation. And then these cells, these fibroblasts, actually differentiate into myofibroblasts. And these myofibroblasts have smooth muscle characteristics that allow them to contract collagen. Then they proliferate, they deposit type 3 collagen, and I'll explain why that's important, and then they form these nodules in these cords. Now, the epidemiology is probably not correct because a lot of what we think is Dupuytren's disease is probably not. But there is this variation of 2 to 40% of the population. It increases with age. It's rare in African and Middle Eastern people. There's a 9-to-1 ratio of men to women. 50% of the cases are bilateral. 8% have contractures, and that's probably 8%. It's probably more if it's truly Dupuytren's. 10% have plantar disease, and 1 to 4% have penile fibromatosis or Peyronie's. And you get this alteration of the palmar fascia that has this very specific pattern. The fibroblasts become myofibroblasts. They proliferate. They produce excessive collagen. The collagen is altered from type 1 to type 3, and then you get these cords and nodules. And so there's a balance of collagen turnover that happens in normal inflammation and trauma. And with Dupuytren's disease, we get this abnormal balance. So one thing to remember, the palmar fascia is 95% type 1 collagen and 5% type 3. But in Dupuytren's palmar fascia, its type 3 collagen is 40%. So it increases significantly. There is this palmar fascial complex, which is well described, these five regions. But the most important aspect of Dupuytren's is the central aponeurosis. So if that comes up on a test, that's what you're looking at. And that's that triangular pattern that you see on either side of the hypothenar and thenar eminence, where it says PA. So Dupuytren's disease, again, progressive disease of genetic origin, fibromatosis of the palmar fascia, nodules, and cords. You get flexion contractures, which cause functional impairment sometimes. Differential diagnosis, again, is non-Dupuytren's palmar fibromatosis. You get this activity-related thickening. I don't know if you guys have noticed this, but people who lift weights without gloves, people who garden, laborers, they get this palmar fibromatosis. Sometimes you see ganglions that could mimic this. Trigger finger, I see a lot of trigger finger where patients think the palmar fibromatosis is what's causing them pain and locking, and it's just above that, maybe due to some inflammation. It's not exactly known. But the other things that this could be is epithelial sarcoma, PVNS, and then sometimes you can see attenuation of the pulleys with rheumatoid arthritis where you get bow stringing of the flexor tendon, which could mimic this. So is this Dupuytren's disease? The woman came to my office really in tears. She saw this. Her doctor told her she had Dupuytren's. She read online and she thought for sure that she was going to get these contractures, and she didn't want any of that. Along the fourth ray in the palm, there's these little bumps there. So I did an ultrasound, and that's what I found. If you look at the top of this, right above that, you see a little cyst. So this is the palmar fascial cyst. This is not Dupuytren's disease, and it's not going to progress. And when I reassured her that and showed her that, she was actually happier. I've had debates online on Twitter with other docs who say, so what, it's not Dupuytren's disease. But patients, at least where I am, really want some diagnosis and prognosis. So there's a common pattern that we see that causes these predictable deformities in Dupuytren's. And what you need to remember is that certain cords cause certain contractures. So the pretennis band causes MP contractures. The central cord causes PIP joint contractures. The spiral cord is what displaces the neurovascular bundle anteriorly. And the lateral cord and the retrovascular cord cause DIP contractures, but the lateral cord can also cause PIP contractures, and this is in testing. The main takeaway from this is that PIP joint contractures are more difficult to treat than MP joint contractures. When the PIPs get contracted for long term, we get tendon elongation, we get contractures of the actual PIP joint themselves, and long-standing contractures are very difficult to correct. But MCP joint contractures could be for years and years and years. You release that cord, that tether, and you get really good correction. Dupuytren's diathesis. A diathesis is a condition that predisposes an individual to a disease or a severe form of the disease. And so when we talk about Dupuytren's, we always talk about rate of recurrence and progression and disease severity. So in Dupuytren's disease, these four things I mentioned here, positive family history, bilateral involvement, ectopic manifestations, and ethnicity, they're all part of the diathesis. And these things predict the progression severity and a more aggressive course. And then obviously, if you have these things, you tend to have a higher rate of recurrence. So these are some of the ectopic manifestations here. You get the knuckle pads that you're familiar with, and then Lederhosen disease, or Lederhosen disease, which is a plantar fibromatosis, and then you get Peyronie's, which is the penile form of it. I left that picture off because I knew it would be after lunch. So in terms of disease progression, we have extension and recurrence. So a true extension is the appearance of new lesions that weren't there before in other places. Recurrence is when you've done a procedure, you've done treatment, and it's come back in that location. And so factors affecting recurrence, these five things, four of which I mentioned before, these things increase the risk of recurrence. So if you have a family history, the recurrence is 2 times more frequent, knuckle pads 4 times, plantar lesions 8 times. And this is from a 2006 article, The Predictive Risk. So if you have all five of those things I just mentioned, there's a 71% chance that your disease will recur. I basically tell all patients there is no cure. It will come back to some degree. So be prepared for, you know, even after a procedure that was successful, that got you full motion, it will come back. So treatment considerations, the way I approach this, I look at all patients individually and I make sure that I understand what their expectations are. Some people just don't like the bumps. Some people truly have functional deficits. So the most reliable treatment that we know as hand surgeons is fasciectomy. It's a means to control the disease. As I mentioned before, there is no cure, but it is risky. And if you're not familiar with the anatomy, right here, that neurovascular bundle was pulled from the ulnar side of the digit right over the cord. So drive carefully. Needle laparotomy, which is my favorite procedure, it was actually designed by a French rheumatologist. And they basically started using these needles to fenestrate the cord, weaken it, and then rupture it. The problem with that is there's a high recurrence rate. Collagenase is an enzyme that specifically cleaves type 3 collagen. So if you inject it in the areas of the tendon, it shouldn't weaken it too much. It is something that takes some practice and it works well. It's just as effective as needle laparotomy. The recurrence rate is very similar. But there was this great study that came out by a buddy of mine, Marco Rizzo at Mayo, which looked at the direct costs and the outcomes for all 3 procedures. And I thought this was fantastic because I've been preaching this and now I have some proof. So if you look, all right, the treatment with collagenase resulted in the highest rate of reintervention at 2 years and comparable reintervention rates with needle laparotomy at 5 years, but it was the most expensive. And the needle laparotomy was the least expensive, and more severe PIP joint contractures and younger age at time of intervention were predictive of reintervention after both of those 2 procedures. Although fasciectomy had a high initial cost, it had the lowest reintervention rate. And look at the difference in cost here. Needle laparotomy, $1,500 in this study. Surgery and collagenase, more than $5,000. So I did a study in my office looking at the different costs involved. And if I do a needle laparotomy, it's about $356 for the patient, Medicare patient. That's how much costs are involved. And it cost me a 22-gauge needle. But look at this, 10 times as much almost. And the outcome is no better, and the recurrence rate is faster. So if you're looking like me, you want to provide value for your patients. And if you look at value as the equation of quality, and to me, quality is outcome and patient experience over the cost involved, needle laparotomy gives you the best value. So we're familiar with most of the complications. This is one that had Xiflex or a collagenase, sorry to use that word. Recurrence is the number one complication, I tell my patients. And then you can get these flare reactions that happen. Of note, you can do carpal tunnel and Dupuytren's contracture release at the same time without an increased risk of a flare. And then there are other complications that can happen, as we're all familiar with. Surgery for recurrence, sometimes you got to be very aggressive. You got to cut out all the diseased tissue. You got to find the neurovascular structures and do a full thickness graft. But the incidence of digital neurovascular injury is pretty high. There are some alternative treatments. None of them have been proven. None of them have gone through really rigorous cost-effective analyses. But there are other ways that people are looking at treating this. The most common one that I see nowadays, because we have a radiation oncologist in my area who wanted to find some revenue sources, and so he does radiation therapy. And so I get a lot of patients who see that doc who actually wants me to map out the lesions for him and give them the depth with ultrasound. But we're just not sure what the long-term effects are, and it's still unproven. But there are some studies in Europe that show that it slows the progression. So patients who are now very savvy, they're on the internet, they look for other alternatives. This is one of them. And so in my practice, the way I manage it, if it's truly Dupuytren's or not, if there's a asymptomatic contracture, I don't do anything. And I recommend not to do anything. Now, I do have some patients who don't like the nodules, who insist on having them taken out. And I do, and most of them are pretty happy. So far, I've been lucky about that. But my go-to treatment is needle laparotomy. And I use it for the simple MP joint contractures. Everyone knows how satisfying that is to release those, and it just opens up. And then rapid progression of PIP joint contractures, because I hate treating those. And so if they're progressing rapidly, I want to get two of them sooner so that we don't get a really bad fix PIP joint contractures. Because I have amputated fifth digits before for patients, ray amputations for fingers. And those patients who've lived like that for years and years actually do appreciate that. So that is one way to treat those. And I'll do surgery for a significant PIP joint involvement, either a digit widget or a contracture release with that. Symptomatic nodules, as I mentioned, the patients want. And then severe recurrence where we have to do a dermofasciectomy and a grafting. Now, if patients want this, I'm in LA, I'm in private practice. Patients come in demanding certain things. And even if you try to talk them into it, they still want something done. And I'll do collagenase if that's what they want. It's not my first line of choice. I try to talk them out of it, but I'll do it with those patients who come in and want to be like John Elway. And then patients who want to know everything about the disease and all the different options, I'll go ahead and have them see the radiation oncologist so that they can talk to him. I'm usually very good at talking patients out of this because I understand the disease much more than the radiation oncologist who's just learning about it. So when they go to that person after seeing me, it's unlikely they're going to want the treatment. Unfortunately, the reverse happens where they go and find him first and then come and see me, and there's no talking him out of it. I've seen the anatomy enough that I kind of know where to make my fenestrations based on what I've seen after I've opened people up. So I have no problem doing the border digits and the spiral cords and the PIP joints. Luckily, I've had no complications with that, but there's always a risk of injuring the nerve or the neurovascular bundle when you're doing that. But no, doing the procedure a little distal to where the neurovascular bundle comes over.
After you do an open fasciectomy, what is your protocol for post-op hand therapy, and when do you start? How long?
Yeah, good question. These days, I get patients involved in therapy right away. So 1 week after, I get them involved in therapy to help with edema control, because we know edema can cause ischemia and can cause palmar fibromatosis to form after surgery, which I hate. It's not recurrence of Dupuytren's exactly, but you get some palmar fibromatosis whenever you violate the palmar fascia. You can get that. So I'll start them right away with that. I do an anti-inflammatory regimen too of ibuprofen, just empirically, and I don't know any studies that recommend that, but I do it, and I have them get a splint made that they wear to bed at night for 6 weeks after.
Is the practice of leaving the incision wide open as a transverse incision, if you do multi-finger releases, would you still leave it open?
Yeah, so that's called the McCash technique, and that's actually quite common. A lot of us will still do that technique if there are small openings, but if I have exposed tendon, pulleys, neurovascular structures, then I'll do a full thickness graft.
Thank you, Dr. Raven. For more information on upcoming meetings from Kaiser, visit kpsymposia.com. Be sure to visit our website, audiodigest.org, to stay up to date on your continuing medical education credits.